by the supernatural. It was a glimpse he would never forget. The assault continues. Janet, would you describe some of the events that took place after you returned from camping out?
Well, the night we got home, Shannon was levitated, and it took us several hours to calm her down. And then Mary.
What about Mary?
To be honest, all of us had this fear in the back of our minds that the demon would do something that would cause her to have a heart attack.
Something like that happened?
The black form came into Mary's bedroom, and it frightened her so much that...
That what?
That we were afraid...
What else happened?
Shannon was thrown out of bed, very violently. We heard the noise in the middle of the night and ran down the hall and found her on the floor, badly bruised and sobbing.
Did she remember what happened?
She said that the dark form had appeared and thrown her out of bed. Threw her so hard that she first hit the wall and then the floor. Then he spoke to her.
What did he say?
One strike, two strikes, three strikes and you're out. That was when Jack sort of went crazy. He saw Shannon there on the floor, and he just couldn't take it anymore. He started shouting at the demon to show itself. He held a container of holy water in his hand and kept calling for the demon to come out. I was very proud of him. He wasn't afraid of the demon at all. He just wanted to have it out once and for all, even if it cost him his life. Then John and Mary came over.
They'd heard the noise?
Yes. Shannon's being thrown out of bed had awakened everybody on our side. Then John and Mary heard that we were up, so they came over to see if anything was wrong. John did something fantastic that night.
What was that?
He brought over this certified relic he has, a wooden cross that contains a thread of the robe of Jesus Christ. He said, "I think the demon means to kill all of us. I didn't used to think that. I thought it just wanted to torment us, but now I think it wants our lives. So I want you and Jack to have this relic to protect yourselves with. But if you don't have it, you won't have anything to protect yourself with," we said. Then Mary spoke up and said, and I'll never forget this, "We're old. If something happens to us, we've lived our lives. You have a family to raise. You take the relic." You could see the tears in Jack's eyes. He was really moved by this.
Did things calm down?
Not really. For Jack, they even got worse at work. The demon wasn't satisfied with destroying our home lives, and even our lives at the campground where we'd been going for years. Now it even wanted to destroy Jack's job.
Testimony of Maria Ramos.
I have worked with Jack for many years at the company. I know him to be a reasonable, level-headed man not given to flights of fancy or wild imaginings. I have to say, though, that when he first started telling me about some of the things going on around his house, I had some doubts. I thought there might be a natural explanation for these events. Then the phone in our office started its really strange ringing. One day, after Jack had explained to me how terrified he'd been the night before by being levitated, I was sitting at my desk when the phone started making this very strange noise, almost like a fire alarm going off. A very long, urgent burring. You almost had to cover your ears. Over the next few months, these happened dozens of times. The phone company sent several repairmen, but none of them could explain the eerie and irritating sounds coming from the phone. Then one day the phone was accompanied by a very filthy odor, as if our office was a dank cellar, that kind of smell. We tried opening windows and spraying the area where we worked, but that didn't help. The smell was what convinced me that there really were supernatural forces working on Jack. The smell and the radio. One day Jack, who looked more and more drained and exhausted from what was going on at home, asked me to listen to the radio on his desk. "Am I losing my mind, Maria? Or can you hear tappings inside the radio?" I listened carefully. At first, I didn't hear anything, but then I began to hear taps. One, two, three taps, like somebody was knocking on the radio with his knuckles. The intermittent tapping went on for several minutes, and then it stopped.
I'm sorry for you, Jack. I really am.
At church, I asked the people in the congregation to start praying for the Smurls. I shared with the others the experiences I'd had with Jack and spoke of the supernatural forces that were working on him and his family. None of us could imagine what such a strain would put on your health and sanity. Just from my brush with it, I'll never forget the sound the phone made, or the stench in the office. I have to wonder how long I'd hold up under such an attack. I don't know how the Smurls held on as long as they did.
Eerie intrusion. Rain threatened in the dark gray afternoon. It was one of those days when the temperature was inexplicably more like October than July. The girls were off playing, though the serious way that Dawn and Kim went at softball, Janet wondered if playing was the right word, and Jack was at work. Janet had made a cabbage salad for dinner and put it in the refrigerator so it would be cold at dinner time. The TV was on, a soap opera playing out its grim view of the human condition, when Janet began feeling a sudden headache and decided to lie down on the couch. As she stretched out, she did not have to wonder why she had been having so many headaches lately. Ever since the camping experience, she and Jack had lived with the knowledge that even if they did sell the duplex and move, the demon might well move with them. So what was the point of going anywhere? If it could follow them to the camp, it could obviously follow them anywhere. She had been asleep approximately 20 minutes when she felt a very gentle touch, like fingers meant to arouse her sexually, begin to move up her thighs and then over her stomach and onto the rest of her body. Abruptly, she came fully awake. Her first reaction was sarcasm. Here we go again. As ominous as the demon could be, it also reminded Janet sometimes of a small, irritating child bent on bothering its parent. Janet waited a moment, then put her head back on the arm of the couch, intending to return to sleep. The headache was still pounding away. She had not quite reached the point of sleep when she felt the touch return. She started up on the couch because this time the demon's touch was even more suggestive, moving carefully toward her belly. But then what had seemed sexually abusive became something even more threatening. The demon's invisible hands found her throat and began choking her. Janet could feel blood filling her face as she clawed out at her unseen assailant.
"Help!"
She did her best to be heard, but she knew there were two things against her. The demon's clutches were so tight she could barely get out a sound. And the house was empty. She couldn't yell loudly enough for Mary to hear. She was thrown off the couch, the demon keeping the pressure on her. Janet saw the blackness of death come rushing at her and realized that her mind was beginning to give in to the blackness, the way drowning victims are said to surrender finally to their own overwhelming darkness. Then she recalled what Ed Warren told her about imagining herself in the protective light of Christ's love. As she started to picture Christ in her mind, Simon came in from the kitchen where he'd been asleep and seemed to sense what was going on in the room. The German shepherd crouched low, baring teeth dripping with saliva, ready to attack Janet's torturer. Simon leapt through the air, snapping his jaws and reaching out with powerful paws, raking at the empty air. He landed next to the couch, still growling but frustrated now, because he could not save the mistress he loved. As for Janet, the picture of Christ she had conjured up became more and more vivid. She saw the Savior with his hands reaching out to her. He wore flowing white robes and was bathed in a beautiful pearl-colored glow. In her mind, Janet reached out and accepted Christ's offer of help. As she moved toward him, she felt herself move within the protection of his beautiful spiritual light. Suddenly, she had a mental image of herself glowing in the same light in which Christ stood. All the time this imaging process was going on, the demon's hands continued to strangle her, and she writhed and fought under the massive strength working on her throat. But the deeper she was drawn into the light surrounding Christ, the less effect the hands had on her breathing. Simon continued to growl, trying to understand how he could help.
"Jesus, please protect me."
The hands had loosened to the point that she could hear herself shout out now. Once again she cried,
"Jesus, please protect me."
By now the mental impression she had of being one with Jesus was nearly complete, and so the demon's hands loosened even more until she could struggle to an upright position.
and grab a container of holy water nearby. She sprinkled drops of the pure water through the air, and at last felt her throat free once more. She had expected her first reaction to freedom, if in fact she did not die, to be one of relief. But instead she sat on the edge of the couch, sobbing, almost without control. She had never been so close to death before, and the sense of it had been terrifying. Only Christ and his light of love had saved her. That night, when she told Jack about the strangulation, he took her in his arms and held her for a very long time. Then he gathered the four children around them, and together they thanked God for sparing Janet's life.
"I don't know what to do next," Janet said.
"I do," Jack said. He went to the phone and called Ed Warren. Speculation. As he always did for exorcisms, Father McKenna fasted for his trip to the Smurls in West Pittston, where he hoped to put an end once and for all to the curse that lay over the duplex like the most terrible, lingering illness. On the day of the second exorcism, the weather offered the cleric some pleasant views of rolling, verdant hills and cloudless blue sky. He arrived near noon to find the Smurls and their children, and Mary and John as well, standing in the living room waiting for him. Before he began the rite of exorcism, he talked a while with Janet and Jack, asking them to tell him about some of the things that had taken place since the first exorcism. Watching them, listening to them, Father McKenna could assess just how strong the demon had become. He saw before him two people ravaged by a force they did not understand. Because he did not say Mass this time, the ceremony was briefer. Father McKenna walked through every room on both sides of the duplex, dispensing holy water and ancient prayers in Latin. Then he blessed each member of the family individually. He even said a special animal blessing for Simon, all these prayers coming from the Rituale Romanum, a document of scarcely more than 25 pages that contains all the ancient prayers and incantations for dealing with demons.
Dominus vobiscum,
he said in the Mass Latin of the traditional church. When the priest had concluded his duties, Janet said,
"There's one big difference between this time and last time."
"What's that?"
Father McKenna asked.
"The demon hasn't done anything."
And so it hadn't. During the first exorcism, the demon had rattled cupboards, taken the form of an angry youngster, and set foul odors on the air.
"Is that a good sign?"
Janet asked. Father McKenna said,
"Let's hope so."
Janet and Jack once again asked the priest to stay for dinner, but he said that he wished to continue his fast, and anyway, had several things to do back at the parish. His eyes scanned the living room. He was long accustomed to the subtlest presence of demons, and he watched for such a sign now. Nothing. His ears were equally accustomed to the sounds of demons. He listened and heard nothing. Father McKenna bowed his head and said a silent prayer that the Smurls would now be left alone once and for all. The Smurls bid the priest goodbye and walked him out to his car. Several neighbors, knowing the rite was going to take place that afternoon, stood on their porches and watched solemnly as the priest got in his car and drove away. Janet and Jack could not contain their optimism. They went inside the house, sniffed the air, looked around. Once again, it felt as if the house was theirs and did not belong to the demon. For the duration of daylight, and well into the night, their optimism would prove well-founded. On the drive back to Connecticut, enjoying the deep green spectacle of summer along Interstate 84, Father McKenna found himself thinking about an exorcism he'd participated in some years earlier, and wondered why he hadn't thought of this before. In the Brenner case, excavation workers who'd been digging up a drainage ditch had found bones wrapped in decayed cloth buried deep in the ground. Father McKenna had a forensic expert examine the bones. The forensics man determined that they were pig bones, at least 800 years old. Immediately, Father McKenna knew why the Brenner's house was haunted. Part of its yard was the site where a pagan ritual had taken place more than 8 centuries earlier. No wonder demons infested the house. As he drove, Father McKenna had the sinking feeling that the exorcism he'd just performed had not worked. Many times following such a rite, he felt elation, but now he was filled with brooding. He could recall few infestations that had presented the problems the Smurls were encountering,
and the priest felt that he had failed to help them. That night, Father McKenna phoned the Smurls to see how things were going. He was half surprised to hear Janet say, "They're going just great, Father, and we want to thank you again."
"No problems, then?"
"None at all. We went out and got a pizza to celebrate, in fact."
"Well, I'll be praying for you, Janet."
"Thanks so much, Father."
That night, as he said his nightly prayers, a tremor of fear passed through the priest. He had a terrible sense that not all was well at the Smurl household. Once again, a sense of failure flooded through him. He felt almost as if he had somehow betrayed this fine family. He closed his eyes and continued to pray. The Apprentice Demonologist.
"You wear clothes you don't mind getting dirty, because even though the movies like to make believe that our job has a lot of hocus-pocus stuff to it, what we really do is look in crevices and cracks and closets and cellars and attics and down chimneys and down wells and down sewers, anywhere dark that things could hide, because that's the kind of place that demons and spirits favor. And instead of crystal balls and fancy robes and magic wands, we carry tape recorders and flashlights and pen lights and screwdrivers and putty knives and hammers and even tweezers in some cases. And on top of that, we take along video equipment and cameras that can shoot in the dark if necessary, and logs in which to note the exact time. And we take along assistants who give us courage, and who let us give them courage because they know we're all part of the team."
Donald Bennett was in his third month as a student of demonology, and Ed Warren was helping him prepare for the day that was coming soon. The day Donald Bennett would quit looking at slides and listening to tapes and would, for himself, enter a house infested with demons. After talking about the instruments and tools demonologists use, Ed looked at Donald and said, "Now, I want to tell you about some people I know. Some people we're going to be visiting soon." Donald Bennett. Just by his tone of voice, I knew that Ed had finally decided to take me along. I'd expected my first feeling to be one of real joy, but instead, I have to admit, I felt my stomach knot up, and I felt my heartbeat increase. There was no doubt about it. As much as I wanted to be a demonologist, going into an infested house still scared me. At that point, Ed proceeded to tell Donald all about this couple named Janet and Jack Smurl. The Terrible Truth. That night, Jack had some problems getting to sleep. Excitement caused him to feel almost supercharged with energy. The house was calm and quiet. His parents had reflected this welcome turn of events. He hadn't seen them smile so much in nearly 2 years. Jack lay in the shadows of the bedroom trying to ease himself into sleep. He thanked God for all his blessings, and within 10 minutes found the darkness that was sleep, and let it overwhelm him gently. Jack came up out of bed as if a shotgun blast had sounded in the hallway. He was bathed in sweat and shaking. Moments later, Janet sat up next to him.
"My God," she said.
They both heard banging in the walls, a sure sign that it had not gone at all. After a time, as the banging continued, Janet and Jack went in to comfort their daughters. The girls were well aware of what the banging represented. Kim, through tears, said,
"Is it ever going to leave us alone, Mom? Ever?"
Speaking in barely a whisper and fighting back her own tears, Janet said,
"I don't know, honey. I really don't know."
After an hour or so, the banging stopped. The girls went back to sleep. Jack and Janet lay in bed, wrapped in each other's arms, watching dawn smudge the window. They were exhausted, drained, and terrified.
"I don't know what we're going to do," Janet said.
"Somewhere there's somebody who can help us.
There's just got to be."
He went on to say something he thought he'd never say.
"Maybe it's time we went public.
Maybe somebody will hear us and call us."
"But the girls..."
"Maybe there's some way we can do this anonymously."
"But how?"
"Let's talk to Ed and Lorraine about it."
"Going public is almost as frightening as dealing with the demon," Janet said.
He sighed, stared glumly at the streaked dawn sky.
"We've got to do something, Janet. We've got to."
But as he thought of all the problems publicity would inflict on his family, Jack said, "Let's give it a little more time.
Let's just see what happens, all right?"
Janet said gently.
All right, Jack, if that's what you think is best.
She held him, and finally, they drifted into uneasy sleep. Father McKenna's sleep was also troubled that night. He found himself spending many long hours saying ancient prayers for the Smurls, prayers the early Christians believed were the only real weapons against Satan. Bright Evil. Janet and Jack had been asleep only a few minutes when the mattress started shaking. Jack. I've never been in an earthquake, but I've heard them described, and this was what our bed felt like. Then it started to rise from the bed, the whole mattress, and us with it. Both of us had been levitated before during the haunting, but not like this, not with the bed being thrown around so violently. Then, just as usual, we were dropped back onto the frame. I did the only thing I could. As soon as the bed stopped shaking, I grabbed a jar of holy water and started to sprinkle the whole bed. We didn't sleep the rest of the night. On the Friday of that same week, the Smurl family sat down to the dinner table only to see the oak hutch in the kitchen open by itself. 18 cups and saucers came tumbling out and crashed to the floor. Bits and pieces of ruined china were scattered all over the floor, and some of the sharp edges put scratch marks on the bottom of the hutch. Janet buried her hands in her face and began to weep softly. She had waited 17 years for the hutch, until they had the money they needed to afford it, and now it was scratched and marred. Suddenly anger overtook her, and she raised her head and shouted, "I hate this house!" Jack and the children spent the next 20 minutes trying to comfort her. Over the next week, the bathroom, which seemed to hold a special appeal for the demon, became very active with examples of infestation, most of it directed toward Janet. On Monday night, as she stepped into the tub, she saw a large, bright human form standing in the corner. It was approximately 5 feet tall and looked like a bright light with shoulders and a head, but no neck, legs, or arms. It had no features that Janet could see. Its golden glow hurt her eyes, as if she were gazing directly into the sun. Terrified, she called out for Jack, but by the time he reached the bathroom, the glowing creature was gone. On Wednesday, as she sat in the tub, she heard a man moaning, "Oh, oh, oh," as if in sexual ecstasy. Janet screamed for Jack immediately. This time Jack stayed with Janet, sitting beneath the crucifix that was over the doorway in the hall. While she finished her bath, he read from a missal. As he read the holy words about the Blessed Mother, Jack and Janet smelled the scent of roses in the air. Janet, I don't have any doubt that the forces from heaven were in the house at that moment to wage war against the demon and to protect our family from physical harm. Unquestionably, the most alarming incident took place that Thursday night, and once more in the bathroom. Janet went to sleep early, but awakened around 2 a.m. Thirsty, she got up to get herself a drink of water. She was tired enough that she didn't give any thought to supernatural beings. She simply wanted a drink of water, and then wanted to go back to sleep. Because of all the incidents lately, Jack had insisted in leaving the bathroom light on all night. Now, as Janet turned into the bathroom, she saw something that woke her up completely. Standing in front of the towel cabinet was the large, hunched, hooded black form that had materialized many times since the house had first been infested. Janet watched, fascinated and repelled at the same time, as the form's hands tried to open the cabinet doors. Seeming to hear her, the figure's head turned to the right and gazed sightlessly at Janet. Janet.
I felt as if the thing was looking right through me. My skin literally crawled. I realized that I had only a nightgown on, and I was worried about it becoming an incubus and raping me. Then it started to move away from the cabinet and toward me. I ran down the hall, stumbling on a throw rug and banging my knee pretty badly, but I kept running. I went in and started shaking Jack. I was afraid the demon might have put him in a psychic sleep. Fortunately, I was able to wake him up right away. He went with me to the bathroom, taking the holy water along. But by that time, the dark form had left. I didn't sleep the rest of the night.
Her fears about the incubus were realized the next night, when Janet, relaxing next to Jack on the bed, felt an invisible hand move up her body. Jack, seeing that his wife was being attacked, grabbed the holy water from the nightstand. After pulling the covers off Janet, he said in a commanding voice, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I order you to leave!" Then Janet picked up the same prayer.
"In the name of Jesus Christ, I order you to leave!"
The unseen hands continued to violate her, but as they sprayed holy water and uttered the words of the special prayer, Janet eventually felt the hands withdraw, her body her own again. Finally, she collapsed in Jack's strong and protective embrace. But the night was not over. After getting to sleep an hour later, the Smurls were awakened by the mattress being shaken violently, much as it had earlier. Invisible punches came next, though tonight they lasted only briefly. But the demon was not done. It picked up the whole mattress and levitated it about a foot in the air, tilting it up and down like a roller coaster. By the time the demon was finished with them this time, their daughters stood in the doorway, crying and praying. Janet cried out,
"This is our house, damn it! Leave us alone!"
Around 3 that same morning, Janet was visited by an apparition of an elderly woman with a pleasant face. Her hair was pulled back into a bun. She wore wire-rimmed glasses with round lenses. Beneath a navy blue cardigan sweater, she wore a faded house dress. She sat at a phantom of a white, colonial-style table. The woman said nothing to Janet, only smiled at her in her pleasant way. "Janet, I had the distinct impression this woman wanted to tell me something, but I wasn't sure what. We just watched each other. The odd thing was, I wasn't afraid. If this was the demon taking a new form, it had taken a form that didn't frighten me. Then she was gone. Table and all, just like that. In her place were these lights, blue, gold, and white, flashing all over, sort of like strobe lights from the 60s. Jack didn't wake up during any of this. I got to sleep just before dawn, and then the phone rang. It woke Jack up. He got it, but there was nobody on the other end. I told him what had happened with the elderly woman. Neither of us could understand it. Usually the spirits were ugly or scary. This one had been reassuring, I guess. Next morning, Janet was in the kitchen doing dishes when she heard a noise on the front porch. Walking into the living room, Janet saw a woman who was a golden, glowing form, even more blinding than the creature the other night. The woman's hair, skin, and clothes were composed of this stunning white gold color. Janet couldn't discern any physical features at all. As Janet cautiously approached the door, the woman, predictably, vanished. That afternoon, doing some cleaning, Janet looked up and saw the same white gold woman standing in front of her. Turning off the vacuum cleaner, Janet started toward the woman, but the woman disappeared once more. Later in the afternoon, the woman appeared once more. This time, the golden glow seemed to have a fiery essence, and Janet sensed for the first time that the woman was here not merely to alarm her, but to hurt her. In bed that night, Janet turned to Jack to say something to him, and she saw for the first time her husband look at her as if she were the demon. "Jack, I hadn't been expecting it. We were just having a normal conversation, I mean. And Janet turned to me, and then steam started coming from her mouth. It really scared me. I started moving away from her, and then I realized that this was exactly what the demon would want me to do. It had forced steam out of Janet's mouth to force us apart. I thought of what Ed and Lorraine had told us about the demon always trying to destroy families. Well, that's exactly what it was doing. So I very calmly told Janet what was happening, about the steam coming out of her mouth, and then she started watching herself and seeing the steam too. In a way, it was sort of funny. We even laughed about it a little. But when I first saw it, it really spooked me, no doubt about that." In the middle of the night, Jack reached over and touched Janet softly and said,
"You awake?"
"Yes."
"It's time, isn't it, to talk to Ed and Lorraine?"
"About going public?"
"Yeah."
Janet thought a moment.
"I guess at this point I don't know what else we can do.
Maybe somebody out there will know something about cases like this."
As they talked, they heard a cry come from one of the girls' bedrooms. They ran down the hall and into the twins' room. Karen was sitting up, tears rolling down her cheeks.
"I saw him again, Mommy. I saw him again."
"Who, honey?
The man in the long black thing?
The black cloak?"
"Yes."
Jack and Janet glanced at each other nervously.
"What was he doing?"
"He was in the hall. I was afraid he was coming down to your room. to get you.
She started crying again. Jack, infuriated, slammed a fist into his hand and went back to bed while Janet stayed and comforted Karen. The demon was beginning to achieve its goal. It was trying to destroy the Smurl family, one by one. There was just one thing it hadn't counted on, and that was Jack Smurl himself. Nobody was going to destroy Jack's family. Nobody. Ed Warren. Father McKenna's sense that the demon had not been overcome by the second exorcism proved to be true. Lorraine, Chris, and I, and at various times other members of the team, stayed in contact with Janet and Jack, offering them advice and any solace we could, which, I have to admit, wasn't much at this point. The demon seeming to be virtually, if not literally, out of control. One subject that came up many times was the rather ominous one of Amityville, which was a perfect example of what could happen when a demon reached the fourth stage of infestation, that being possession. At Amityville, of course, 24-year-old Ronald DeFeo had taken a rifle and systematically murdered his parents, two brothers, and two sisters. Today he is in prison, sentenced for life. Until the murder, Ronald DeFeo had been a normal young man, filled with the desires of most young men. But some sinister force in the Amityville house had taken control of him, and the sad and bloody results have since been well documented. Lorraine and I spent many long days and nights after being called into the Amityville case trying to determine if Ronald had merely gone insane or if he'd become demon-infested himself. All the evidence, and it was considerable, pointed to the latter, and we're still learning things about the Amityville situation that only strengthen our belief that it was a clear and classic case of possession. Now we begin to worry along the same lines about the Smurls. What if the demon took control of someone in the house and turned an otherwise innocent mind to dark and violent thoughts, much as Ronald DeFeo's mind had been turned to dark and violent thoughts? Father McKenna had done all he could, and so had we. And yet the demon and its attendant spirits still prowled both sides of the duplex in West Pittston, its ultimate goal becoming more and more obvious. It wanted to destroy the Smurl family by whatever means necessary. One option we considered was getting a group of priests involved in the situation and seeing if, in a collective way, we could derive some plan or insight that would drive the demon from the household. To be blunt, and I say this as a most devout Catholic, we had no luck whatsoever in interesting the church in helping us. Diocese officials are often skeptical of the supernatural because they fear being drawn into a hoax or something that will later be explained away by perfectly logical means. About this time, Janet and Jack were getting desperate. They phoned once to say that they were strongly considering selling the house, and they phoned another time to say that they were now about to simply abandon their home. We told them the terrible truth. We explained that the demon could well follow them, just as it had to the campground on at least two other occasions. And we also told them that they might buy a new house, only to find that the demon lurked in the attic or basement or even kitchen. We convinced them there was nothing to gain in moving. Janet seemed particularly, and understandably, depressed by this conversation, because Jack's sister, Cindy Coleman, had arrived at the Smurl house with her husband and teenage son, Davy. Cindy had had a horrible supernatural experience in Janet's house. While using the bathroom, the light on, she had become entirely surrounded by darkness, as if at the bottom of some deep abyss. She remained in the abyss so long, she wondered if she wouldn't lose her mind. Finally, the darkness lifted, and she saw the bathroom again. The demon once more demonstrated its power, just as it had a few days earlier when Scott Bloom, a nephew, had seen a black figure standing on Jack's and Janet's front porch. Janet said,
"We've been talking, Ed. We think it's time we went public. Maybe when the diocese hears our story, they'll be forced into helping us."
It was a sort of decision neither Lorraine nor I could make for them. It was a sort of decision, a very serious one, that might well have a great lasting impact on their lives and the lives of their children, that we had to let them reach on their own. "You sure?" I asked.
"Yes,"
Janet said. "You realize if word gets out,
You could be
laughing stocks.
She finished the sentence for me.
Nothing could be worse than what we've been going through the past few weeks, Ed. Go ahead. See if you can figure out the best way to make our story public.
By public, Janet meant the public at large. By now, many people in West Pittston knew about the Smurls and their tragic dilemma, and in general, most had reacted sympathetically. But it has been our experience that when the public is confronted with something it both fears and misunderstands, think back to what Martin Luther King had to endure, or what AIDS patients must go through today, it can be a fickle and vicious judge of others. I said again, "You're sure this is what you want, Janet?" There was a pause, but only a slight one, and Janet Smurl said,
"Yes. Yes, I'm sure."
In Philadelphia, there's a television talk show called People Are Talking, hosted by an intelligent and open-minded man named Richard Bay. He had already invited Lorraine on, so we called him and asked if we could bring the Smurls along. We promised him that his viewers would be intrigued and shocked by what they had to say. Bay agreed, and so we set down certain conditions. Both Lorraine and I still had reservations about the Smurls revealing their identities, so we got Richard Bay's promise that they would be presented behind a screen, so that they could not be recognized by viewers. And so that no one would know their last names, we would refer to them only as Janet and Jack. Bay agreed to all our conditions, and plans were set for our TV appearance. The Apprentice Demonologist. The basement door was closed. Donald Bennett listened as, near the front of Jack and Janet Smurl's duplex, Ed and Lorraine Warren moved around with two other members of the psychic team. Now, as Donald smelled spices from a rack over the stove, nutmeg was especially pleasant, his eyes moved to the doorknob, and he wondered if he should have volunteered for this assignment after all. While both Ed and Lorraine had been in the basement earlier today, and while Lorraine had received many clear psychic impressions of the place and found it safe, Donald felt anxious about going back down there alone. He smiled weakly at his fear. This was a lot different from lying on your bed in your parents' home and eating Fritos and reading a book about the occult. Over the 5 months he'd been preparing for this day, Donald had seen several people drop out of the program. He'd even seen a strapping big military man reduced to tears after spending long hours in a house heavily infested with malevolent spirits. As Donald stood there, he heard the floor creak. In the twilight, the kitchen was gauzy with darkness, and the sound of the aged boards made him start. He spun around, his mind racing with all sorts of dark and frightening images, to find Ed Warren standing there.
"How you doing, Donald?"
"Oh,
fine,"
Donald said, swallowing heavily. Ed grinned. "Were you kind of afraid about going down there?"
"I volunteered,"
Donald said. Ed continued grinning. He put his hand on Donald's shoulder. "Doesn't mean a fellow can't be scared, just 'cause he volunteers, I mean." Now Donald grinned.
"I always thought I'd be brave."
"Believe me, you are brave. Otherwise you wouldn't be in this house at all." Donald's gaze fell back on the worn metal doorknob. Ed said,
"I'd be glad to go with you."
Donald silently thanked the older man, but then stopped himself. He'd been waiting for this moment for so long, and now he was going to spoil it for himself. Or was he?
"I think it'd be better if I went down there myself," Donald said.
"You sure?"
Donald nodded.
"Okay,"
Ed said. "Lorraine and I are going upstairs." He started to turn, then paused.
"You positive?"
"Positive."
Ed's easy grin appeared once more.
"Gotta admit, I'm glad you're doing it alone."
Donald laughed.
"Why don't you come downstairs in about half an hour and tell me that?"
"Hell," Ed said. "I'll even bring you a cup of hot chocolate."
"I'd appreciate that," Donald said.
Then all that was left was to go down the basement steps just as he'd been planning all along. Alone. He set up a tape recorder and set the tape to rolling, and then he took out his logbook and started making notes on what he saw. He accounted for his time in 5-minute increments. Twice he heard noises he couldn't explain, and he jerked up from the straight-backed chair in which he sat.
but when he shone his light around, he found nothing unusual or untoward. Then, as best he could, he sat back down and tried to relax. The basement smelled of sudsy laundry water and sweet fabric softener. In one of the small oblong windows, you could see dirt along the bottom of the glass, and in another, you could catch a fragment of the night sky and golden clouds racing across the quarter moon. After a time, he took out his flashlight and began a thorough examination of the basement, every corner, every crevice, every possible place a spirit could use as an entry point or hiding place. He catalogued each of these carefully. He was on his hands and knees when he heard something that sounded like a piece of chalk scraping across a blackboard. He jumped up so quickly that he banged his head against the side of the washer, hard enough that he nearly knocked himself out. While holding his left hand against a lump quickly forming on his forehead, he squinted out of one eye to see what had caused the noise. And that's when he saw that the sound was coming from the dryer, some malfunction of the motor. And that's how Ed Warren, coming down the stairs with the promised cup of hot chocolate, found him, sitting on the floor, holding his head, from a self-inflicted wound. "What happened to you?"
"You don't want to know," Donald said.
Ed looked worried. Donald felt obliged to tell him.
"I got injured, and it wasn't even a spirit," Donald said, concluding his story.
Ed helped him up and gave him his hot chocolate. Then Ed pointed at the watch on his own thick wrist.
"Yeah, but you know what?"
"What?"
Donald said, still smarting from the pain.
"You did what you said you wanted to do. You wanted to stay down here half an hour by yourself, and that's just what you did."
But even though Ed's voice swelled with pride for Donald's accomplishment, he sensed that the young man was deeply disturbed.
"I learned something while I was down here," Donald said.
Though he knew what Donald was about to say, Ed kept his face free of any expression. He simply let the young man talk.
I'm not cut out to be a demonologist, Ed. It's just too frightening, is the only word I can think of. Down here, I sensed things I'd just as soon forget.
Ed put a steadying hand on Donald's shoulder.
"You don't need to justify yourself to me, Donald. You're not the first person to make that decision, and obviously you won't be the last."
"I just feel so damn ashamed, I guess."
Ed laughed.
"Ashamed of what? Of not wanting to spend your life searching in dark nooks and crannies for demons? You think that's something to be ashamed of?"
He nodded to the stairs.
"You feel like going out for a pizza?"
"You kidding?"
Ed smiled.
"I've never been known to kid about pizza."
Today, Donald Bennett is employed by a large multinational corporation, is married, and still has nightmares about his half hour in the basement.
"It's not something your mind ever lets go of. I know it sounds corny, but I was in the presence of true evil, and it really shook me, just paralyzed me in a way. I knew then why so few people stay in the field of demonology. It just takes too much out of you."
An eerie trip. Kim, Shannon, and Karen stayed at home with John and Mary Smurl. Dawn visited the Colemans in New Jersey, and early on a Tuesday evening, Janet and Jack got into their van and set off for Philadelphia along the beautiful Pennsylvania Turnpike. The month was July, and the rolling hills were furious green. Jack:
"It started out being very relaxing. We were very nervous about what we were going to do, tell our story on TV and all, but we found the trip itself real pleasant. The scenery was great, and it was a chance for us to be alone and just talk about normal things. Then something started kicking me in the back."
Jack felt the pressure of a boot grinding into his backbone. The kick was so hard that he was knocked forward into the steering wheel. To keep the car from going off the road, he had to slow down and grip the wheel tightly. Janet could see that Jack was suddenly drenched in sweat and that his face had become pale.
"Something's kicking me!"
Without a word, Janet reached for the holy water she carried in an aspirin bottle. She quickly sprinkled the back seat of the van, then spoke the words of the prayer the Warrens had taught them. Almost immediately, the kicking stopped.
"I guess it doesn't want us to tell our story," Janet said.
Jack surprised her by smiling.
"Good. Then I'm glad we're doing it."
But the incident in the van would not be their only demonic experience that day.
Once they reached Philadelphia, Janet and Jack checked into a Holiday Inn. They had a good dinner in a nearby restaurant, then went back to their room. They had been lying down for 20 minutes when the mattress began shaking violently. By now, they were well familiar with this particular form of haunting. Holy water, dispensed in great dollops by Janet, brought the shaking to a stop, at least for the time being. Around midnight, the presence began pounding on the mattress with such forceful blows that Janet and Jack had no choice but to sit in chairs and smoke cigarettes, just watching the demon go berserk. From down the hall, Janet could hear the laughter of two couples who were returning to their rooms, slightly drunk and having a good time. How simple my life used to be, she thought. She watched the obscene force continue to pummel the mattress.
"We'll be so tired we won't make any sense on TV," Janet said.
Somberly, Jack replied, "I think that's exactly what it's got in mind, honey." In the morning, the Smurls were exhausted and depressed. Not even in a motel far from home could they get a good night's sleep. Ed Warren. Lorraine had been fighting a head cold all week, so when we met the Smurls for breakfast, about all she felt like eating was a poached egg and a piece of toast. The dining room was the sort you see in most modern motels, well-appointed if you like furniture that is pressed wood rather than real wood, and rather grand in design. Lorraine had once joked that she thought motels hired madams to do their interior decoration. I had to agree with her. The Smurls looked bad, nervous and weary, and after they described their night, I certainly understood why. They sat across from us in the dining room playing with the breakfast rather than eating it, and sounding as if they were having second thoughts about going on the show. Peripherally, I saw what happened to Lorraine, but at first I didn't understand the significance of what was going on. Janet, startled, said,
"It's in here."
And so it was. Our chairs sat with their backs to a blank wall, yet here was some unseen entity lifting Lorraine's chair half an inch from the floor and smashing it into the table. I groped in my pocket for holy water and immediately began uttering the prayer that was never far from my lips. Lorraine, long accustomed to the manifestations of the beast, looked anxious, taking my hand as I continued to pray. The entity left us then. You could feel it withdraw, the air less disturbed, its presence shrinking and then disappearing. Lorraine smiled bravely.
"I'd say there's somebody we've made very angry."
The Smurls tried to smile too, but they managed only the barest of responses. Their demeanor did not bode well for our appearance on Richard Bay's TV show. Working in most modern TV studios is a bit like working aboard a submarine. Massive doors seal you into an environment that is dark except for small areas illuminated by great blasts of light. People move like phantoms in these deep shadows, carrying clipboards and wearing headphones. Being in the studio only made Janet and Jack more frightened. The set resembled that of most modern talk shows. We were put in the center of the stage area, while host Richard Bay sat on the edge of the lighted circle. Janet and Jack faced the audience directly, though they were concealed behind a gauzy screen. Before the show began, Bay talked to the Smurls, obviously trying to reassure them that, given the lighting setup, nobody at home would be able to see their faces. For the first time in hours, Janet laughed.
"Isn't this how they interview mafia people?"
"In the shadows, you mean?" I asked. She nodded. I grinned back. "Now that you mention it, it is." Richard Bay is known as a tough interviewer. Not excessive, never malicious or petty, but his questions are hardball as opposed to softball. Well-dressed, tanned, confident, Bay managed to seem genuinely interested in the plight of the Smurls while remaining skeptical about some of their experiences. He asked the questions his viewing audience would. How did the Smurls know that their experiences couldn't be explained by natural causes? Were they a troubled family and therefore given to the kind of quiet hysteria you find in broken or damaged homes? Had they ever sought professional help, i.e. psychiatric help, to help them deal with the phenomena that were plaguing them? These were the sort of questions people like the Smurls always got at the beginning of an interview. But after about 10 minutes, something very curious started to happen. Before, Bay and the audience alike had been given to occasional uncomfortable titters and laughs, but as Janet and Jack began to talk at length about everything from the mysterious black form that moved from one side of the house to the other, about Jack's rape, about Shannon being hurled down the stairwell, gradually you could see a change in both Bay and the audience. Where before they'd been skeptical, now they were rapt and serious. Lorraine and I corroborated what the Smurls were saying. To the inevitable question of why the Smurls didn't simply move, I interjected an experience of my own. I explained that once when I was in England, I'd tape-recorded a demon, the horrid voice on the tape telling me exactly what my wife, who was 3,000 miles away in Connecticut, was doing. I assured the audience, preternatural entities, which are negative ones, transcend distance and time, and can follow people wherever those people go. To confirm this, I pointed out that the demon had followed the Smurls to Philadelphia and had ruined their night in the motel room. Then Janet and Jack talked about the two exorcisms. The audience seemed especially fascinated by this subject. They asked if the rites had been anything like the movie The Exorcist. Janet and Jack explained how the movie had been exaggerated for dramatic effect. While they were talking, Father McKenna phoned in and addressed the studio audience. He talked about why some of his exorcisms worked and some didn't. Though he could not prove this contention, he said, it was his belief that the religious rites may have been unsuccessful because of some occult items buried in the ground beneath the Smurls' home. During the entire interview, Janet expressed bitterness only once, and that's when the subject of the Catholic Church came up. She said that the family had received virtually no help from the church. Lorraine agreed, saying it was sad the way some churches treat families that are haunted, and she urged that church officials spend more time helping families instead of being doubtful. Richard Bay asked me, "Are demons afraid of anything?" "Only one thing, really, Richard. The power of God." "Can you summon up that power?" "Through prayer, you can." Bay, smiling, said that after all these years of being psychic investigators, we probably weren't Satan's favorite people. I said, "He knows who we are. In many hauntings, we've heard our names called out. Does that frighten you?" Lorraine said, "Of course it does, Richard. Of course it does." Then Bay wondered aloud if demons haunted friends of the Smurls who'd been in the house. Janet said, "Unfortunately, yes." Then she related several of the more unnerving experiences of friends of theirs. Finally, it was time for questions from the audience. One woman, obviously upset, said, "Could demons follow any of us in the audience home?" Nervous giggles. "It's possible," I said, "but probably unlikely." I went on to tell them that simply by discussing demons here, we were giving the dark world recognition. "So," I said, "I envisioned the entire audience in Christ's light before the show began, just in case." Another woman in the audience talked of an experience she'd had with a Ouija board, and how it had told her she was going to hell. Lorraine promptly cautioned the audience and viewers about using Ouija boards, and said that in the majority of the cases she and I investigate, people had invited the demons in by first communicating with the supernatural world through such tools as the boards. There were other audience questions, and as always, we found that those who'd come to scoff turned out to be the most interested of all in the twin subjects of supernatural and paranormal phenomena. Janet and Jack never relaxed, however. Lorraine and I kept looking in their direction and smiling. You have to appreciate what they were going through. They'd had a terrible night, and now they were being asked to reveal some of their most intimate secrets for a television audience. It wasn't the kind of soul-searching most of us would want to do in public. Richard Bay's final question was the most somber one of all. He asked what I thought was the ultimate goal of the demon. I answered him simply, "It wants to destroy the Smurl families." "Why?" "In our experience, we've found that diabolical forces hate loving families. The Smurls live in the image of God, and this, the demon finds totally repugnant. So it wants to destroy them." Bay wanted to know if we could stop the demon. "I'm hopeful we can," I said. I wish my words had sounded more confident and purposeful, but given all that had happened over the last few months and thinking back to some of our other cases, I knew that occasionally demons did triumph for a time, until psychic investigators and ordained members of the clergy could figure out deterrence. The show finished, the audience gave the Smurls long and warm applause, and I could see in the tired faces of the couple something like gratitude. Afterward, Janet said,
"The audience was very nice to us."
Lorraine said, "They knew you were telling the truth, and they respected you for it." Jack said to me, "What do we do next?" "All we can do is wait and see what happens. We need to be in constant contact on the phone." Janet said, her eyes misting over,
"Right now, I'd just like to see our kids."
Lorraine leaned over and kissed her on the cheek. "That sounds like a good idea. Why don't you leave now? You can be home before supper time." From the parking lot, we waved goodbye, smiling all the time. But when we were alone, I said,